On page 8 is a refuge and bodhicitta. Bodhicitta being the aspiration to awaken in order to bring all to awakening. Perhaps the highest and most profound aspiration that the human mind has ever conceived. The idea that we can dedicate ourselves to the welfare and awakening of all conscious life. And to do that, we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and the spiritual community. So, in Buddha, Dharma, and supreme spiritual community, we go for refuge until fully enlightened by the power of all six perfections, from generosity to non-dual wisdom. For the sake of all beings, may we realize Buddhahood. So begin by bringing awareness to the body. And finding a posture that is relatively erect, but also relaxed. Because it's that combination of a relatively erect body that combined with relaxation that fosters the alert, calm awareness that we are practicing with. So just take a moment to settle. You might move the body however you wish to just find a posture that works for you. Feel free to move the body in any way that will allow you to release tension. And you might like to take some slow, deep breaths as a way of deepening the relaxation further. So you breathe in and let the air fall out. Breathe in and let go. Breathe in and let go. And notice that the inhalation is an active process which involves contracting muscles, but the exhalation can just be a relaxation and a release. So that you breathe in and then just let go. So that each exhalation becomes a further releasing and relaxing. Breathe in and let go. This structured practice we're doing, the cutting through, can be simply viewed as a relaxing with awareness. And to take that relaxation to a further level, let's just do three breaths in which we allow a sound to emerge on the exhalation. So breathe in. Let go. Breathe in. Breathe in. And you might wish to foster the opening of awareness by just taking a minute or two to listen for the furthest sound. Let your awareness expand to include the furthest sound you can hear. So we relax with awareness and allow things to be exactly as they are. Not needing to change or struggle with anything. Aware of the body, sensations, stimuli, and aware of the awareness of those things. accepting each experience and letting it be as it is. And when we accept each experience, there's no strain or struggle. Just relaxing and being aware. Hi, I'm Roger. I'd like to add my welcome to the retreat. Looks like everyone survived the first day. I'd like to talk this evening about how we can optimize our time in the retreat, how we can make this the most valuable experience, as valuable an experience as we can, drawing on the wisdom of wise people through the ages, what they've told us about retreats and how to work with them and how to benefit from them. It's really a remarkable and rare opportunity to be able to do a retreat. There's a practice in Tibetan Buddhism, the practice reflecting on a free and well-favored life, which essentially looks at all the things that have to come together, all the benefits that have to cohere in one lifetime for anyone to be able to practice. You have to have good health, you have to have free leisure time, have to have a teacher and teachings and many other things in order to be able to do a retreat. So it's actually a very rare thing and an extraordinary opportunity. And it's also perhaps one of the greatest gifts we can give, not only ourselves, but to the world. Because really what we're doing here is cultivating the very quality which this world so desperately needs. Retreats have been a central part of the lives of some of the most outstanding people who've ever lived throughout history. Certainly many of the great religious founders, the Buddha, Muhammad, Jesus, for example. And they've been part of the lives of some of those people who've contributed most to human well-being. In fact, the great historian Arnold Toynbee, in his survey of world history, found what he described as one of the common characteristics of those people who he felt had contributed most to the world, to be a what he called a feature of their lives called the cycle of withdrawal and return. And what he said was that people who contributed deeply to others seemed to go through a cycle or cycles in their lives in which they periodically withdrew from the hustle and bustle of daily life and withdrew in order to turn their attention inward and to wrestle with the fundamental questions of existence, to do some sort of introspective practice, some sort of contemplative discipline, which allowed them to explore what it is to be a human being and how one can live most fully and effectively, and also how one can realize the deepest insights and understandings and gain most wisdom about life. And having taken this period of withdrawal and turned attention inward and explored these great questions, then these people went through a phase of return. So this was a phase of withdrawal and return, and return to the world in order to share the benefits they've learned and in order to help and to heal and to teach. And this is described in across the world's traditions. In our own Buddhist tradition, one thinks of the 10 ox herding pictures of Zen, which show a person training the mind and withdrawing into solitude. And then the final picture is titled Return to the Marketplace. And it shows this practitioner who's returning to the world, and to all extents and purposes just looks like anyone else, but brings a profound perspective and a healing and transforming capacity with them when they return and interact with others. So it's an extraordinary opportunity we have here, an opportunity to cultivate some of the most valuable qualities of heart and mind that anyone can aspire to, and a chance to discover who we are, who we really are. And this actually is the great secret of life. You know, there's an enormous amount of time and energy that people put into trying to figure out the secret of life. But it's this, the secret of life is what's called in the Tibetan tradition self-secret or an open secret. Wise people have been screaming it from rooftops for centuries. And basically the secret, you know, the secret of life is you. That we are the secret of life, that when we discover who we are, we find that we are far more than we think. In fact, we're more than we can think. And this has been described in various ways across traditions. But in the Buddhist tradition, in various ways, but one nice succinct phrase is, look within, you are the Buddha. But also in other traditions, and I mention other traditions here just to, throughout this talk, particularly to give a sense of how universal some of the themes and the benefits of retreat are. So within the other great Indian tradition of Hinduism, there's a saying that Atman, which is our individual consciousness, and Brahman, the universal consciousness, are one. Or in the Christian tradition now, the Western monotheisms, the kingdom of heaven is within you. Or in the words of Muhammad, those who know themselves know their Lord. Or from China, in the Confucian tradition, the words of the great sage Mencius, those who know completely their own nature know heaven. And many of you have probably worked with the I Ching, the Book of Changes, which says, in the depths of the soul one finds the divine, the one. So this is a common theme, that when we turn attention in and explore who we really are, we find that we are so much more than we ever dreamed of, even more than we can dream. And that this is the great secret of life, but it's an open secret. It's a secret that all of us can are openly invited to realize for ourselves. And the way of realizing it is through spiritual practice, and particularly through the intensive practice, which we have the opportunity of doing here. So retreats are a wonderful opportunity, but they can also be rather challenging, as you know, and particularly in the first few days, and particularly your first retreat. And I can promise you it gets easier and they get easier. But it's a real challenge, you know. We come from these extraordinarily busy lives for the first time in perhaps in a lifetime, give a prolonged period of time to not distracting ourselves from our experience, but actually immersing ourselves in it and going as deeply into our experience as we can. And it's hard to sit still when there are aches and pains and difficult emotions and things arise. All the things we've been pushing aside or distracting ourselves from tend to surface. And if you're like me, in the first couple of days of retreat, you may find yourself fantasizing plots and plans for how you can make a graceful exit from here. And I've had various fantasies in my time, ranging from the ridiculous to the more ridiculous. I remember once thinking and planning how I could phone my assistant and get her to phone the office and say I had to leave immediately on urgent business. All sorts of fantasies. But the benefits are worth sticking around for. And so retreats at various times can seem endless, but actually, in retrospect, they're very short, and a week is a very short part of our lives. So the question then comes up, how can we make most use of this time? You have made considerable sacrifices to be here. You've left your comfortable routines and family and friends and made a financial investment and a time investment, and you're challenging yourself, and you're willing to basically do something quite heroic. A few years ago, there was a retreat here led by, I forget whom, but I think it was a teacher who's been working with the military, and I think he had the 82nd Airborne Division here. And it was quite an interesting scene because some of the T-shirts, here these people, these guys sitting in, you know, great husky guys sitting in meditation, some of them with T-shirts, death from above. So, and at the end of the retreat, some of them, you know, these are guys who'd been through some very tough training. Some of them said this was by far the toughest thing they'd done. So I bow in admiration to you and your willingness to be with everything that comes up over this week. It is a kind of a heroic journey. It's not the heroic journey that our culture is fixated on, which is the heroism of overcoming external things. This is the heroicism of being willing to be with whatever arises in our experience. So how do we optimize our time here? Well, wise people have given us suggestions over the centuries, and what I want to do is just distill that advice. So, first thing you may want to do at various times is just reflect on the benefits of doing retreat and why you're here, to recall why you're here, to deepen motivation and to inspire yourself. Now, reflection, most of our practice is oriented towards allowing the mind to settle and calm and still, and fostering or actually using a direct intuitive seeing, that is, just resting in awareness, or more technically, using a transrational intuition, a direct seeing into the nature of reality. A transrational, that is, not a thinking about, not a figuring out, but a direct intuitive seeing. But there can be a time for reflection. And reflection is a way of using thought consciously, carefully, and intentionally to cultivate desired qualities. Qualities such as insight or understanding or motivation or inspiration. So this is very different from the random mental fireworks that usually go on in which we get lost into trains of thoughts. This is a conscious, careful intentional reflecting on. And reflection is the source of wisdom. Knowledge comes from acquiring information. Wisdom comes from reflecting on experience. So what might you want to reflect on as a way of gaining inspiration and fostering insight? Well, you might want to reflect on the benefits of this retreat and the intensive practice you're doing. Recalling that retreats such as this are the most superb way available to us of fostering mental and spiritual well-being and maturity, and of cultivating particular qualities of heart and mind, so the most exquisite qualities of heart and mind that are available to us, energetic or peaceful qualities such as calm and equanimity, emotional qualities such as love and compassion and joy, and perceptual qualities, clarity, precision of awareness, and understanding of ourselves, of our minds, of suffering, of the world. So one thing to reflect on is just how that some of the goodies, the benefits that come from practicing. And retreats also allow us to focus on what really matters, what really is important in life. And in doing this, you might consider reflecting about what is your sacred question. That is, each of us, whether we recognize it or not, and if you're here, you probably recognize it, has at least one sacred question. A question that might be, for example, how can I love? Or how can I be of service to people? Or how can I grow in wisdom or compassion? These are central questions. A sacred question is a central existential question about the nature of life and our lives. And whether we know it or not, our lives center around and circle around our sacred question. And the depth and value of our lives is to a significant extent a function of how consciously we engage with our sacred question. We only have to look around our culture to see that our culture is oriented towards distraction. Distraction away from the deeper questions and issues of life. And that distraction exacts a cost. This is one place which is set up to minimize distractions, where we can deeply explore our sacred question. And the depth with which we explore our sacred question determines the manner in which we live and in which we die. So one way of looking at this is, what qualities inspire you? What would you most like? What qualities of heart and mind would you most like to embody and express in your life and communicate and share with others? What would inspire you in the moments when there's pain or frustration, or you wondering why you're here? What quality that you're cultivating here is inspiring? So those are some things to reflect on: the value of the retreats and our sacred question. Another thing is just to keep in mind how brief this time is. If you live 100 years to 100, you'll have 5,200 weeks. This is just one of them. So it's a pretty brief period, and it'll go very quickly in retrospect. But the benefits may last a lifetime. So it can be useful just to recall how brief this time is and to attempt to make most use of it. And one final thing that's very valuable to reflect on is that we're not doing this for ourselves alone. The qualities we cultivate here are really the qualities that the world needs most. You know, our world is in desperate trouble. And if we look at the source of those troubles, for the first time in human history, each and every one of the great crises we're confronting is human-caused, which means that at some level and in some way, it's an expression of our collective states of mind. The state of the world is a reflection of the state of our minds. And what we call our global crises are actually global symptoms. They're symptoms of our individual and collective neuroses, pathologies, immaturities. So the work you're doing here to grow in wisdom and kindness and compassion are really the most fundamental antidotes that the world needs right now. So it can be really valuable to recall that you're not doing this for yourself alone. You're really doing it for everyone. So this is the first suggestion then, to occasionally, as it feels appropriate, to reflect on the benefits of this retreat, the qualities you're cultivating, how quickly it'll be over, and the fact you're doing it for everyone. Second practice is to observe the precepts. We take the so-called lay person's precepts when we come in here to avoid harming and killing conscious beings, not to steal, not to engage in sexual activity, not to engage in wrong speech, which in this case means silence most of the time, and not to take mind-clouding intoxicants. And we do that for various reasons. At one level, this is an ethical training. But ethics can be understood at many levels. At the conventional level, ethics is a set of rules that you do because That's what you have to. But we're not really interested in conventional reasons for practicing here. We're interested in the deeper contemplative reasons. And the fundamental reason we take on the precepts are twofold. One, because they benefit everyone, including ourselves. But second, because they benefit us in a particular way. They benefit us because when we do them as a practice, they're a mind training. One of the things that's really crucial to know about ethical and unethical actions is that they are expressions of our state of mind. And that when we act unethically, if you turn your attention in at that moment, at a time you're tempted to hurt someone in any way or put your benefit ahead of their well-being or deliberately harm in any way, what you find at that moment is that your state of mind is one in which is dominated by painful, destructive motives and emotions such as greed, fear, anger, or jealousy. And if you act those destructive motives and emotions out, you strengthen them. That's the key. That's the mind training level of avoiding unethical actions. Now, the positive side of that is when you are moved, as you will be many times here, by a desire to help or heal or in others in any way, whether it's by action here or by thoughts or plans of when you get home, if you turn attention inward at that moment, what you'll notice is that your mind state is dominated by healthy, joyous emotions and motives such as love and compassion and generosity. And when you act those out, you strengthen those. So that's the deeper contemplative understanding and motivation for practicing the precepts. It's not just to follow a set of rules. It's a profound and fundamental mind training. In fact, it is the fundamental bedrock on which other contemplative practices rest. It's really hard to sit still in meditation if you've spent the day being unkind to people and hurting people. And I'm sure you've noticed that what tends to come up in really powerful, compulsive ways are memories of when you hurt other people or when you were hurt by them. In other words, unethical actions have, and memories of them, tend to be very highly charged for us. So we are working with ethics here, working with the precepts, in order to not just to follow a set of rules, not even just to have a harmonious and supportive community, but in order to train and tame and transform and eventually transcend our own minds. Here's a quote from Jack Kornfield. At first, precepts are a practice. Then they become a necessity. And finally, they become a joy. That's why all these things are called a practice. We practice the qualities of heart and mind we desire, and until they become a spontaneous expression of who we are. Now, there are various ways or levels of working with these precepts. We can think of them as outer, inner, and secret. Outer is simply restraint. That is, we basically restrain ourselves from doing anything unethical, anything that brings harm to anyone, including ourselves. And this is an essential first step. But if it's the only level on which we work, then there's a danger of fostering repression and a sense of sacrifice and even resentment. So we want to work more deeply, as I've been talking about, out of the recognition that this is a mind training. And on the inner level, we actively work with and transform unethical motives and emotions. And we do this by investigating in a couple of ways. When you notice that unethical motives or emotions are arising, you investigate them. You can turn attention towards them and explore them. And one of the beauties of awareness, mindfulness, is that when we turn attention to unskillful mental qualities, they tend to transform and release. Or if we want to work at this inner level with unethical mind states, then we can cultivate opposing qualities, opposing positive qualities. So, for example, if there's a feeling of love, we can of anger, we can practice forgiveness or cultivate the emotion of love. But then there's still a deeper way of working, and that's with the Dzogchen practice, in which we simply recognize that we simply allow unethical motives and states of mind to arise in the field of awareness and recognize that in that field of awareness they will release by themselves. That awareness in and of itself is healing and transformative and transcending. And that if we can simply rest in awareness, then these painful, unskillful, unethical motives, emotions, states of mind will transform and release and dissolve of themselves. They'll do what's called self-liberate. When they do, they'll release energy. And you may find that there's greater clarity and energy available. So the deepest Dzogchen practice for working with unethical states of mind is simply to allow them to be and to continue resting in awareness. So what does this mean in practical terms? Well, in practice, we just simply follow the precepts we've taken, and we observe the states of mind that arise in connection with them. And if unethical states of mind arise, if there's greed, fear, anger, jealousy, if any of those or others arise, then if we can, we simply relax and remain resting in awareness. If they're too strong, if the greed or fear or anger is overwhelming, then by all means move into a more active way of working with it by turning attention to it, exploring it, investigating it, or by doing something to counteract it. Okay? So, first thing we can do to enhance our retreat, to use reflection when appropriate. Second, to follow the precepts. Third is to do less. And in Buddhist psychological terms, this becomes reducing what are called the outflows. And outflows are activities which tend to trap and distract energy and attention by drawing attention and energy outward and dissipating them. And outflows essentially, consist of unnecessary activities. particularly activities done mindlessly or carelessly. And in the retreat context, these are things like speaking or writing or reading in ways that aren't helpful or excessively. And at the most subtle level, thinking. So what are some of the ways we can reduce outflows? Well, first, and this is again getting back to one of the precepts, maintaining silence. In retreat, this is one of the few opportunities in life to escape the incessant busyness of life and to escape the tranquilization by the trivial, as Kierkegaard called it, that our culture, more than any other in history, has mastered to an extraordinary degree. And so we practice silence because when there's silence within and without, then we can hear the wisdom that cannot be spoken, the wisdom that waits beyond words. And this has been a common theme of wise people across history and across traditions. The Native American wise man Black Elk said, "For is not silence the very voice of the Great Spirit?" And Father Thomas Keating, who wonderful Christian contemplative, who's been instrumental in bringing centering prayer back to this culture, said, "Silence is the language God speaks, and everything else is a bad translation." And the third Zen patriarch, whose wisdom is distilled into a few pages, which have to be one of the most profound and succinct summaries of wisdom that's ever hit the planet, said in those few pages, "When we seek the sacred, the more you talk and think about it, the further astray you wander from the truth. Stop talking and thinking, and there's nothing you'll not be able to know." This environment is relatively silent. And particularly if you go back out in the desert, it's even more silent. And I invite you to listen to that silence, because one of the things you discover when you do is that in order to hear outer silence, you have to have inner silence. In those moments when you're really hearing outer silence, you'll also notice that the mind is silent. So, if you hear the sound of the bell, notice what happens as you follow it into silence. Notice that when you listen, as the sound disappears, mental activity also disappears. So, first thing then to do for reducing unnecessary activity and reducing the outflows is to maintain the silence. Second thing you may want to do is to reduce the amount of reading you do. Or if you do read, then to do it in a particular way. Do it as contemplative reading, what the Christians call Lectio Divina. And this is a very different kind of reading. This is Father Thomas Keating again. "We tend to read scriptures as if they were just another book to be consumed. Lectio is just the opposite. It is the savoring of a text, a leisurely lingering in divine revelation. With sacred reading, we're seeking insight rather than information. Consequently, the reading is slow and reflective, a few sentences or even words at a time. So if you wish to read, you might consider just reading in that manner, just a few words or sentences, and letting them resonate within you. Recalling that you're reading for inspiration and insight rather than information. Likewise, you may want to minimize writing. By all means, you know, take some notes on your experiences, record key insights, but it's not a time for major journaling or for writing that essay you didn't get done or the book you've been planning for the last 10 years. And finally, at the most subtle level, and where it gets down to a really contemplative level, is not to indulge thinking. And thought is extraordinarily powerful. We create our world with our thoughts. You know, literally, we create our world with our thoughts. Everything that's going on in the world, all the human activity at the moment, is a function of thought. And it's interesting that the Buddha began his teaching. The opening lines of the Dhammapada begin with these words: "We are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts we make our world. It is good to control them, and to master them brings happiness. But ah, how subtle they are, how elusive. The task is to quieten them, and by ruling them, to find happiness." Now, but this has to be done in a very delicate way. Certainly not by fighting thoughts. This practice, this structured practice we're doing, is about relaxing and allowing things to be as they are. And I'm sure you've noticed by now, we don't have a choice as to whether thoughts arise or not. But we do have a choice how we respond to them. And the amount of choice we have is a function of the amount of awareness we have of them. So one extreme, we can indulge in thoughts, you know, get lost into them. At the other extreme, we can simply remain relaxed and aware and allow them to pass through the open space of mind. And when we remain in that relaxed, open, aware state, then thoughts don't have any power over. Very interesting contrast. If we're mindless and a thought, "I'm scared," arises, then the next moment or instant, the body starts pumping adrenaline, the muscles contract, there's fear, there's anxiety, the mind starts spinning, and we ask, we're scared. However, if in that moment the thought arises, if we are in a relaxed, open state, then the thought "I'm scared" arises, it's like, "Oh, that's an interesting thought," and has no power over us. Thoughts only have power over us when we basically have some degree of unconsciousness around them, when we get lost into them and identify with them, and they become not something we look at, but something we look from. So how do we work with thoughts? Well, now I want to be careful here not to imply that we want to get into any kind of struggle or fight with thoughts at all. The ideal is simply to maintain our relaxed awareness and to let them pass through the open sky of mind. And then like clouds passing through the sky, they don't have any effect. But we get caught at various times, and so it's useful to just have some skillful ways of working with them. One thing that's useful is to remember that we've got the rest of our lives to think. This is 1 week where we don't have to. So it can be useful when some tempting thought or fantasy arises just to remind yourself or say to yourself, not now. Not now. I'll think about that next week. Another thing that's useful to remember is that during this week, nothing is worth thinking about. And you may want to make a resolution not to indulge thoughts. You know, they're very seductive. But you may want to make some sort of resolution. Okay, for this week, or for this sitting, or whatever, I'm not going to indulge them. Doesn't mean thoughts won't arise. Doesn't mean you won't get lost into them. It's just means that in those moments when you recognize you have a choice, you remember your commitment is not to indulge them. And if you wish, you might want to do part of a sitting in which you specifically try to identify any thoughts that arise. So you make a decision that the next 5-10 minutes, I'm going to see how many of my thoughts I can recognize as they arise. And thoughts are very subtle. They're kind of the stealth bombers of the mind. They kind of just go through, and often we don't even recognize they've been there until they've passed. Sometimes we catch them as they're disappearing. But with practice, as we settle and calm and still, we become more aware of them, catch them more quickly. And again, it's not to make this a struggle. One of the real things we do not want to do is to get into a fight with our minds. We've spent a lifetime fighting and struggling with our minds. It's a very painful practice. And it's a wonderful discovery to recognize that the mind is quite capable of functioning all by itself. It doesn't need us. In fact, it functions much better when it's left alone. All we have to do is bring some awareness to it. And then I promise you, you will discover that the mind is a self-organizing, self-healing, self-transforming, self-actualizing, self-transcending process. We've had a very unfortunate relationship to our own minds. Almost everyone in this culture lives in fear of their own minds. And one of the most exquisite discoveries you will make during this retreat is that you don't have to be afraid of your mind. In fact, you can come to trust your own mind. And that is a wonderful, freeing, releasing and relaxing discovery to really get that you can trust your mind. And to the extent you get that you can trust your own mind, to that extent you don't feel, you recognize that you don't have to compulsively fix it. You don't have to interfere. You don't have to change things. You can just allow, just be aware, and the mind will handle things the way they need to be handled. So another thing you may want to do to reduce unnecessary activities and outflows is to slow down. The mind and the body are intimately linked. And this is the basis of a lot of spiritual practices, practices like yoga and breath control and posture. Here's a little experiment. Close your eyes for a minute. And notice how you feel. Notice your state of mind. Now put a smile on your face. And notice how you feel. Okay. And when you're ready, open your eyes. I almost said open your mind. That's good too. So that's just a taste of the intimate link between mind and body. So if we slow down, then the mind slows. In fact, when you slow the body, you also slow and settle and still the mind. And as part of that, it can be very valuable, just do one thing at a time. Attention reflects activity. Do many things and attention will be fragmented. Do one thing and attention can be focused. So, first suggestion, conscious reflection. Second suggestion, practicing the precepts. Third, reducing unnecessary activities and outflows. The fourth, being continuous in the practice. Sometimes said that continuity is the secret of success. And the analogy is boiling water. If you put a kettle on the stove and take it off after a minute, and then put it back, and then take it off. It takes a long time for the water to boil. But if you leave it on, it may boil in just a few minutes. Likewise with practice, there's a mental momentum that builds when we practice continuity of awareness. When we sit and then as we stand up, try to maintain awareness, and as we move out of the hall and walk, try to maintain awareness and to try to bring awareness to everything we do. And this can get very refined and ideally get very continuous. And when I was at one stage, I was practicing in Burma, and some of the questions they asked us were there any moments during the day when you weren't mindful? And yes, as a matter of fact, there were. And did you fall asleep on an in-breath or an out-breath? Damned if I know. Did you wake up on an in-breath or an out-breath? I haven't a clue. But this was the kind of continuity that they were aiming for. The direction is towards uninterrupted practice, what is in Zen is called every minute Zen. And in yoga it said this is the art by which one transforms the whole act of living into an uninterrupted yoga. Now related to this is to transform all activities into spiritual practices. Fifth suggestion. All activities, walking, eating, showering, can be transformed into spiritual practice simply by bringing awareness to them. But also, even more so if you wish, by doing what we do with our practice here. You'll notice that each sitting, we begin by generating bodhicitta, the aspiration that what we're doing may serve our welfare and awakening, and also the welfare and awakening of all. And we can generate that aspiration before any activity if we want. And you might wish, for example, before eating, to just take a moment to do that for prayer. May this food nourish and provide energy for this body and mind so that it may heal and become healthy and awaken, and then become an optimal instrument for the healing and welfare and awakening of all. And at the end of an activity, you'll notice at the end of each sitting, we offer the benefits. So-called, that is, we do something almost paradoxical. We aim to give the benefits away. We offer them to all beings. And this is done in a kind of wonderful judo-like manner, which relies on based on a very profound understanding of the way the mind works. Because one of the things that this offering the benefits is based on the recognition that within the mind, what you intend for another, you tend to experience yourself. That is, if you intend that someone else be hurt, you almost invariably you will discover that there's anger or fear or greed or jealousy there. And when you explore those, they hurt. On the other hand, if we intend for others to be happy and joyous and loving, then those qualities are cultivated within our own minds. So it's really this offering the benefits is based on a profound insight into the fact that what we give, we get. So in this way, we can transform everything we do in the retreat and everything we do in life into spiritual practice. And one thing you might want to do while you're here is just choose one specific activity for particular care and attention. That is, you might choose one thing, like opening doors or putting your shoes on and off, and decide that you're going to bring as much awareness as you can to that activity during this week. Now, let me ask you, did you take off your right shoe or your left shoe first when you came in here? Now, I hate to admit that I knew I was going to ask that question. I can't. I don't know. It was one of them. Anyway, that kind of choice to select one activity and bring particular attention to it can be very valuable. Seventh suggestion is to relax. Effort is essential for practice, and right effort is one of the components of the Eightfold Path. But the effort has to be balanced. It has to be. Effort does not mean strain and struggle. Sometimes it does. But particularly in this practice, effort at its deepest simply means being present in this moment. So relaxation helps this practice. And in whatever way you can do to release and relax tension in the body and mind, please do it. Related to that, the eighth suggestion is to enjoy yourself. Really, joy is one of the, in Buddhist psychology, joy is one of the healthy mental factors. So by all means, do whatever will bring you joy here, real joy. If you want to walk in the desert or contemplate a flower or whatever will bring you joy. Really, seriously, make one of the goals for this retreat to give attention to those things which bring you happiness. And one thing you can do for this is to celebrate or enjoy your awakenings. By now you've realized that within a single sitting, we tend to fall asleep and wake up dozens and dozens of times. And each time you wake up, there's a choice point. Often the automatic tendency is to berate yourself for having fallen asleep. Oh, damn, I fell asleep again. Oh, God. But, and you can do that several dozen times during a sitting. And the result is you don't feel so good. But there's also the choice of each time you wake up of taking just a moment to think, oh, wow, far out, I just woke up again. And to enjoy it, really to celebrate the awakening. Not by having a, you know, not by in some long train of thought, but just to recognize, oh, how wonderful, I've just woken up. Enjoy it. Bring joy into the mind at each awakening. You'll have lots of opportunities. Over this retreat, you'll fall asleep and wake up thousands of times. And the whole basis of the spiritual path is to wake up one more time than you fall asleep. So those are suggestions that wise people have given us over the centuries for how we can make most use of this time. And I hope you notice that one of the real emphases is on relaxation and joy. And that from a conventional perspective, some of these things can look like sacrifices. From a deeper perspective, the deeper the practice becomes, the more we recognize that they're not a sacrifice at all. They're actually what we most deeply want to do, and they're what actually most deeply bring us the deepest and most sustaining peace and joy. So, anyone like to comment or question?
Thank you very much.
I'm just wondering if, for me, I feel like there are places where my mind gets captivated or overthrown by emotions that feel like they precede thought, and then I'm trying to figure out what is this.
What is this? You mean what is the emotion?
Yeah, or where is this coming from?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, in this practice, you don't really need to figure that out. Insights about that will arise of themselves. All we have to do, all this practice asks us to do, is bring awareness to all our experiences. So there's really no need to do that kind of figuring. It's very hard to do that without getting lost in thoughts and to add more agitation to the mind. So, yeah. So that kind of thinking of discursive, thinking about, figuring out, probably isn't so helpful and even beneficial. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Good, thank you.
I'm just kind of curious about the 6 o'clock sitting and how is that for the people that like to get up early, or is that important?
I would say do what you feel will most benefit you and your practice. That's a general principle for the whole retreat. Yeah. Okay, we're actually a bit over time, so why don't we just take a moment to offer the benefits. So may all that we have experienced and explored and learned together serve our welfare and awakening and allow us to more effectively serve the welfare and awakening of all.